Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Osama bin Laden may be dead, but efforts are underway to make the war on terror permanent. And former presidential candidate Denis Kucinich says the U.S. had no right to try to kill Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi.
But first, the U.S. Justice Department is investigating the Newark, New Jersey Police Department for brutality, abusive searches, bullying of citizens, and false arrests. The charges were brought by the New Jersey Civil Liberties Union. We spoke with Larry Hamm of People Organized for Progress. If Newark has had a black mayor since 1970, why is it still necessary to call in the feds to deal with police brutality?
That's because the problem goes much deeper than simply the skin color of whoever might be the mayor or whoever might be sitting on the city council. This problem is a historical problem in Newark, but it's not just a Newark problem. This is a national problem, and it has almost everything to do with the history of black people in this country, how, in fact, we got here. We got here basically through force. I mean, we didn't voluntarily get on those slave ships. It was racial terror and genocide, essentially, that was waged upon us, that took 100 million Africans out of Africa and brought them across the Atlantic, most of them dying in the Middle Passage, but some reaching these shores. And then once we got here, we were once again the victims of unbridled terror. We had no rights, and both the state and the slave masters in their private sphere could inflict on us any amount of pain and suffering that they wished to do. I believe that this thing was so pervasive and lasted so long that it's basically a part of the social psychological makeup of this country, whereas people who are in authority or people who are legally empowered to use force think that they have a right to use force against us for whatever reasons they deem necessary, which is another form of being guilty, you know, rather than innocent until proven guilty, guilty until proven innocent. So this has a long history. I've actually seen pictures of protests in the South going all the way back to the 30s where people are holding up hand-drawn posters, you know, talking about stop police brutality. People forget that even in the March on Washington in 1963, people weren't just carrying signs about passing the Civil Rights Act. They were carrying all kinds of signs, and some of those signs had to do with police brutality. Even Dr. King, even in one of his more his milder speeches, which was the I Have a Dream speech, you know, Dr. King gave much sharper speeches than that, but even in the I Have a Dream speech, Dr. King talks about police brutality explicitly in that speech. So this is a long problem. I mean, Herbert Aptheker, who is a historian, had done research that showed that the development of modern police forces in our urban areas, as we know them today, actually have their origins with the movement of black people from the South to the North after emancipation. And essentially, I mean, anybody that's seen any of these civil rights documentaries, I mean, who was it? More than the Klan that we had to confront. It was the local police and the state police and county police that were putting the dogs on us and beating us and throwing us in jail if we were lucky enough to get to jail. You could not keep a system of racial separation, racial segregation, discrimination, racial violence, racial terror. You can't hold a system like that in place except by the use of unbridled, naked force and repression. and this is a legacy in the United States of racial. This is a legacy of racial oppression. And this is one of the reasons I think it's so difficult to do away with, because it's deeper than the law. It's ingrained. You know that some folks have a right to use force against us, whether it's necessary or not. 90%, 95% of the victims of police brutality tend to be black and or black and Latino.
So in a society that devalues black life and black rights, black police act accordingly, just like white police.
Absolutely. I can even remember my grandfather. This is the truth. I couldn't make this up. Even before I had any idea of what police brutality was, I can remember my grandfather saying back, you know, in the 50s, he said, black cop will beat you worse than a white cop will. Because a lot of times these black cops are compensating, you know. They have to prove themselves. They have to prove that they are members of the gang in blue, you know, and they have to prove their loyalty and their dependability, you know, and many times that results in them being as brutal or sometimes even more brutal. I remember during the Faison case, when during the trial they were talking about statements that had been taken through deposition, and how, you know, one of the officers said it was the black officer, Peyton, because it was four white officers and one black officer. It was Peyton who took his gun out and stuck the barrel of it in Earl's mouth and said, I should blow your effing head off. You know, there are exceptions. You have police and former police like Brother DeLacy Davis, Black Cops Against Police Brutality, and the 100 black officers there in New York. You know, there are exceptions, but they are the exception and not the rule. When the insurrections came during the 60s, when the rebellions came, it was black uniformed people, be they local police, county police, state police, or National Guard, or U.S. Army. When ordered to do so, most of them followed orders to repress those rebellions, repress those insurrections, and do what was ever necessary to stop our struggle for liberation at that time.
That was Larry Hamm of People Organized for Progress in Newark, New Jersey.
Members of Congress were caught quietly trying to broaden the legal scope of the so-called war on terror to allow the president to make war on almost anyone he designates as a threat. About two dozen groups sent a joint letter to Congress expressing their dismay, including the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bill Quigley is the center's legal director.
The Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU and many other groups feel this is a very, very big thing, because the authorization for use of military force that was passed after September 11th allowed the United States military to go after people responsible for the attack on the United States at that time. And as a result, the U.S. military and the U.S. government have said that was enough authorization for us to go into Afghanistan and enough authorization for us to go into Iraq. Some people debate that, but that's what it's been so far. But there is a new declaration of war just included in the new defense authorization bill. And this new definition of war just completely changes the legality of what the military and executive branch can do. And it not only broadens the geographical scope beyond Afghanistan or Iraq, it actually broadens it to any place in the world where there is somebody who might be suspected of terrorism against the United States. So it would say that the United States can go into Yemen or can go into Pakistan or could go into France or could go into Britain or go into Russia or go into China. If there was somebody that the United States thought was a terror suspect. And not only any place in the world, but it also, because it just says any place, it could mean that the U.S. military could conduct exercises in the United States against people that they would consider to be terrorists. So this is a blank check to the executive branch and the military to go wherever they want, whenever they want, against anybody that they think is a terrorist. And it's not even limited to people who are a threat to the national security of the United States. It is just in case of anybody who is, that they think is a terrorist. So it opens the door to commit the United States to a worldwide war without clear enemies, without any geographical boundaries, and without any time limits. So it's essentially the Congress giving a blank check indefinitely and probably forever to whoever is president to conduct military activities any way they want to without congressional oversight.
So this pre-authorizes a president to declare a state of war against any group or individual in the world.
Well, there's a technical difference between taking military action and declaring war. So he wouldn't even have to declare war. He could just say there's a terrorist there and authorize the military to go and take action. And they may or may not call it a war. But the effect of the people on the ground in that place is war, yes. There's no doubt about it. And it brings up echoes of what we've seen, just in the last month or so from the Obama administration of taking a military action inside of Pakistan and military action inside of Libya without any authorization from Congress, which is on its face is totally illegal. It's not allowed by either U.S. law or international law.
It seems to moot the power of Congress to declare any specific war by giving permission to the president to take any action he deems necessary against anyone.
That's correct. I mean, that is the effect of what this change would be. And this is a change that was sort of sneaking into the law, and the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU and a number of other groups, human rights groups, peace groups, Muslim Public Affairs Council, Physicians for Human Rights, Pax Christi, the Catholic Peace Group, and some others, sent a memo earlier this month opposing this section of the proposed law and pointing it out to people. It was really just sneaking through. Very, very dangerous action for anybody who believes either in peace or in, the U.S. Constitution, where there's different branches of government that are supposed to hold one another accountable and responsible.
This seems on its face to be an attempt by this administration to take the so-called war on terror into areas that even George Bush did not try to grant himself permission to go.
In all fairness to President Obama, who, is making plenty of mistakes in this area, this is something that's being pushed by the chair of the House Defense Committee. And the president hasn't taken a position on this yet. But he also has not come out and said that he's against it. So this is something that we hope that Democrats and we hope that the president will oppose, but there's no evidence of that so far. And as we've figured out in the years since we've had President Obama, hope without evidence doesn't really bring us very far.
Well, certainly the president, being not just the president but the head of the Democratic Party, would be aware of these kinds of activities.
Right, exactly.
It was up to the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights to raise the alarm.
This is not something that was brought to us. So the ACLU really took some leadership on this. We joined with them, and there's a big group of organizations that are trying to make it public at this point. And we thank Black Agenda Radio for helping spread the word.
Regardless of what U.S. law is or how U.S. law is interpreted, there is a thing called international law. Did what occurred with the attack on Colonel Gaddafi's residence in Libya, the attack in which his youngest son and three grandchildren were killed, did that conform to any norm of international law?
I think not. The thing that people have to understand is that the United States is at war in Afghanistan. We're at war in Iraq. Those are wars that you could say were authorized by Congress after September 11th as part of the response to 9/11. We think clearly at the time that this is wrong to go into Iraq, but Afghanistan was clearly the theater of war, understood by that. Iraq, you know, the president pushed that through on the basis that it was a severe threat to the United States. Obviously, that didn't prove the case, so it was an optional war, but they at least could argue that that was came out of the authorization for war. Libya, there is no authorization by the Congress for the United States to bomb any target, military or civilian, in that country. This is a totally, on the law, it's totally illegal war. And to further, even if it was authorized, the direct targeting of civilians in any conflict violates international law. So there are a whole host of illegalities committed in the targeting of places where you think innocent civilians might be. Occasionally that happens, and the Army or the Navy or the Air Force will always say, well, the target wasn't those folks, the target was these militants. They haven't even bothered to try to say that that was the point in this one. And it's a terrible tragedy when anyone's children, grandchildren, and civilians are killed. But when they're killed in an illegal war, I mean, I'm no fan of Muammar Gaddafi. I don't think he's not. I really wish he would go, and I hope that the people who are challenging him in his country are successful. But that does not give us the right to intervene in another country's civil war, to use the technology that we have to bomb military, transportation, and civilian targets without authorization of Congress. We don't. The military doesn't have the authority to do that. The president is ordering them to do that, but the president doesn't have the legal authority to do that, but he's done that anyway.
Well, certainly this was either a hit on Gaddafi or a demonstration to Gaddafi that he could be hit, this attack that killed his family members. Isn't it against U.S. law as well as international law to assassinate heads of state?
That's correct. Not just of heads of state, but of anybody by the United States has been prohibited specifically since Gerald Ford. Even President Reagan was against that. And after it came out that the United States, through the CIA and other military folks, were engaged in assassination attempts in Cuba and Latin America and the Middle East, that they came out and said, you can't do that. You can't do that in war. You can't do that in not war. And you certainly can't do that in an illegal war like this. So you're right. It violates U.S. law, violates U.S. law that we're even there doing any of this stuff, and then it violates U.S. and international law that civilians are targeted.
So it seems then that based upon these interpretations of law, the United States can use its full spectrum dominance to kill whoever it wants, whenever it wants.
I think politically that's exactly right, that the United States has the power, has the authority to act in most any place in the world, and does not at this point feel that it has to follow its own laws or the laws of the international community whenever it makes up its mind that we being our country, that our country thinks that it's right. And this is a tragic, tragic road that we're going down. It's one that all of the major powers in history have come to an end, have come to an end when they don't respect their own laws, or they don't respect international laws, they don't respect the laws of other countries. They just decide, well, this is important, so we're going to do it, and the end justifies the means. It's a terrible thing to say, but it's a very, very shameful chapter in the United States history. And the world knows it. You know, the United States, we're not dwelling on that with our local media, but the rest of the world is very aware that we are violating our own laws and international laws just because we can get away with it.
I know that this is a tricky subject, but at what point, when the U.S., the superpower, declares itself above the law, are other nations and individuals no longer bound to act within the law themselves?
You know, that is very tricky, because if you recall, even when the United States set up Guantanamo, there were opinions coming out from John Yoo, from Attorney General Gonzalez, David Addington, and a number of other people saying that interrogators at Guantanamo and other places could bend, even break the law in terms of dealing with people if they did it because they felt it was really important to follow a higher law to be able to protect the lives of other people. And that sort of clearly intentional violation of the law opens the door for any country, any place, to violate the law as long as they can live with the consequences. And it also, this has the effect of further reducing the United States' ability to talk about human rights or to talk about rule of law or talk about respect among nations with anybody in the world, because it's so easy for people to say that we're hypocritical. Why would anybody listen to us about rule of law or transparency or accountability or human rights when we are serial violators of these laws ourselves? And I think that's what Pakistan is saying to us again and again here in the last 2 months with the various actions that we have taken there. How can the United States preach to Pakistan that it should follow human rights? And how can the United States preach to Pakistan that they should respect the borders of its neighbors? And how can the United States tell Pakistan that they should institute and follow a rule of law when we violate it so flagrantly in our dealings with that country ourselves?
Some people believe that it's inevitable that the United States, which already carries out military activities in Pakistan that the Pakistanis officially at least object to, that it's inevitable that the United States take this further and engage in something that even Americans would recognize as a war against Pakistan.
Well, there's an awful lot of drumbeats about that, particularly since the killing of Osama bin Laden. You see the politicians in the Democrat and Republican Party and the drumbeats on their so-called talk shows and other things talking about Pakistan owes us this and Pakistan owes us that, and we have given them money, and what have they given us in return? And I think there are a fair number of people very fearful that as more of the U.S. military leaves Iraq and more of the U.S. military is scheduled to leave Afghanistan, that the United States military wants and its supporters need another target in that area, and that that target might be Pakistan. The biggest problem with that, of course, is that Pakistan is not Afghanistan or Iraq. They are a big country. They have nuclear weapons. They have very strong soldiers. They have a lot of technical prowess that the other countries didn't have because we have given them a lot of that, and so have other places in the world. So if we get into a conflict with Pakistan, it's going to be a conflict that could really trigger doomsday scenario that people have been worried about so much ever since the invention of nuclear weapons and ever since the United States showed what was possible with our bombing of the cities of Japan.
It seems to be unanimous among American pundits that the United States' hands are clean and maybe heroic in the assassination of Osama bin Laden.
I doubt that the world is worse off with Mr. bin Laden's death. But I think that the way it was handled has, again, diminished the United States in the world and has diminished our respect for the law. But the assassination of bin Laden violated a number of our own laws and a number of international laws. And people, it might be understandable for people who are not involved in international relations or diplomacy or international law or that to be happy that somebody who, bragged about so much destruction happening in the United States is gone. And I can understand that, but there are a large number of people in the United States who are silent about this because they know the United States has no legal authority to go into any country in the world and carry out a military operation. The U.S. soldiers are not allowed to fly into France, Italy, Russia, China, any other place to carry out a military operation without authorization by Congress. And then, secondly, according to all reports now, Osama bin Laden was not armed, didn't have a gun there, wasn't shooting at the soldiers, and he was shot right in the middle of the head. The third thing is that, this is another country. This is a country that has its own military, has its own things, and we went into another country without their permission, without authorization, without their consent, without even their knowledge, and killed quite a number of people in something that we are saying shows how strong we are as a nation. And these pictures again and again of people chanting USA, USA, USA is such a provocation to the rest of the world, which is saying that the United States can go anywhere, can kill anybody under any circumstances whenever it decides that it is appropriate. Am I or others going to mourn the loss of Osama bin Laden? No. He was not a force for good in this world, but it is how we treat the people who are our enemies that, you know, that's what law and justice and those things are for. They're not for our friends. They're not for the people we get along with. It's a gauge of how we treat our enemies and those that we detest. It is a gauge whether we follow the law, we are transparent, we are accountable, we follow international law and U.S. law, and we violated an incredible number of those principles in the killing of Osama bin Laden.
Bill Quigley of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
What effect will the elimination of Osama bin Laden have on the people of Afghanistan and Pakistan? We pose that question to Samir Dasani, Asian Coordinator for ActionAid International.
It's difficult to say. I mean, in the countries that I work in Afghanistan and Pakistan, bin Laden was a very divisive kind of a figure. In the northern areas in Afghanistan, in the areas that are dominated by other ethnicities, other than Pashto ethnicity, so that's Tajik and Uzbek and Hazare, these places hate the Taliban, and they also have a hatred for bin Laden as well. So in those places, of course, his death would be celebrated. The problem is that in the Pashto communities, many of them sided with the Taliban. Many of them not in the beginning, not in 2001, but what's happened since then is you have NATO aerial bombardments, and every one of those bombardments that kills civilians sort of builds up support for the resistance. And the resistance is the Taliban, the resistance is bin Laden, the resistance is Al-Qaeda. So you have this real divide in Afghanistan between the Pashto and the non-Pashto communities. And what this will do, and this is a part of the world that sees things in sort of tribal language, right? So there have been sort of family feuds. If we can remember our Shakespeare and Romeo and Juliet and you know, the idea of a family feud. There have been family and tribal feuds in this part of the world going back many, many centuries. That's the culture. So what we've done is we've continued the feud. We have killed someone who's identified as being on a particular side. And what that does is that always exacerbates the feud. So now you'll have certainly attempts, who knows if they'll be successful or not, but certainly attempts to take out figures on the other side, figures in the Afghan government, figures in the U.S. government, figures in leading Tajik and Uzbek figures, perhaps, who knows. That's almost given, in fact, even if you look at what the U.S. is saying, I think the U.S. also agrees with that assessment. Now, all I'm saying is that this is not the solution. The solution would be to break the cycle of violence. In the case of bin Laden, it would have been to bring him to justice without killing him, ideally. I mean, if he really did put up a lot of resistance, then fine. But everything that I've read, everything that I've seen about the latest even U.S. account indicates that if they had a decent police operation, they could have easily just captured the guy. So you respect rule of law, you hold someone accountable according to rule of law, and you break this eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth kind of mentality, and you say, no, it's not about vengeance, it's about justice. But that's not what we did. We possibly made the matter worse.
The event occurred in Pakistan. Last year, 1,000 civilians were killed by drones in Pakistan. How does Pakistani opposition to the United States present, how is that affected by the Osama event?
In Pakistan, I think the situation is quite different. In Pakistan, I think the overwhelming feeling is, you know, how one of sort of shame. National shame that this is someone who had been hiding in Pakistan for a number of years, and that the Americans basically, you know, showed up Pakistan by going in illegally, without even bothering to ask permission, and proving that, you know, he was hiding in Pakistan. I think that's one overwhelming emotion. I think there are other emotions that are in line with what I sort of described as the Pashto feeling in Afghanistan. I think there are some people, a minority of people, but some people who viewed bin Laden as a kind of a hero. And I think those people are, again, likely to be, you know, to feel some momentum. This is not, you know, as Martin Luther King would have said, the weakness of violence is that it adds to hatred, it adds to violence in the world. So when you've taken a very violent solution, or what you think is a solution, what you'll often find is that just breeds more hatred and ultimately more violence. So I think that's a sentiment within Pakistan. I think it's a minority sentiment. I think the majority sentiment would be, wow, I can't believe a criminal was hiding in the country and no one even knew about it, or no one takes responsibility for knowing about it.
That was Samir Dasani speaking from Turkey.
Kathy Kelly of Voices for Creative Nonviolence recently returned from Afghanistan, where U.S. drones kill civilians with regularity. We asked Kelly, what is the greater crime, killing thousands of innocent people or taking out one guy?
Well, I think the common denominator between these two realities is that the unmanned aerial vehicles, like the Navy SEALs, are being used in a situation where there's no court, no witnesses, no evidence, no jury, no judge. In the case of the drones, it's almost as though the role of jury, judge, and executioner is all wrapped up into one. In other words, these are issues of extrajudicial assassination. And according to international law, that's not something that you can just overlook, because the country that's performing this is one that believes itself to be exceptional. And I think we have to ask ourselves, how exceptional do we deserve to be? I mean, this slaughter of civilians in a country that is supposedly our ally, being done by remote-controlled aircraft that have, you know, pilots looking at grainy screens and trying to follow so-called high-value targets, this is something that should be discussed, it should be debated, but it's barely even noticed. And I think, unfortunately, it could be met with the same jubilance that many expressed upon the killing of Osama bin Laden.
I remember that during the 2008 presidential campaign, candidate Obama's military advisors were announcing that there would be a huge increase under President Obama in drone attacks, that this was the way to go in terms of that war, and that would separate the Obama military strategy, the increased use of drones, from the Bush military strategy.
Well, I think that it's a good idea to recognize that President Obama has certainly been consistent with his campaign promises to escalate warfare in Afghanistan. Now, I think that the reliance on both drones and also the Joint Special Operations Forces that are skilled in death squads, assassinations, and night raids are the tactics of choice, both in the view of General Petraeus and President Obama. And, of course, now General Petraeus is moving over to the CIA. This, I think, is a way of waging warfare which was observed by some other advisors, including a fellow named David Kilcullen, who was an advisor to Petraeus, as a means of creating terrorists faster than you can kill them. I don't think that it necessarily enhances our security to have so many families enraged. Well, why are people so angry? If we at all imagine the shoe on the other foot, how would we like it? And if we think about the likelihood, the predictability of proliferation, we may find out how we'd like it, because other countries can get this kind of technology. In fact, they already have it. And if we make the norm being able to attack and kill so-called high-value targets because we've declared that people are a risk to our security, then we might find that other people don't feel too secure living on this planet with us and could acquire this technology.
Is this the meaning of full-spectrum dominance, that the United States not only can kill whoever it wants, whenever it wants, but has the right to kill whoever it wants, whenever it wants?
Well, it certainly seems to be the meaning, and also when you look at the weapons that we've exported to other countries that have used these weapons in the same way. And I'm really thinking specifically of Israel, which has used drones and also many, many weapons that the United States has supplied Israel with to attack innocent civilians and to do so exercising a disproportionate capacity to kill. And we have that because our populace pays huge amounts of money every year to a defense establishment. I mean, the way that a couple of analysts for one conservative newspaper put it, was they said it cost $13 trillion, essentially, to kill Osama bin Laden. When you calculate the price for the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, the ways in which the U.S. has pumped up its own security measures here in the United States, it's just making us more secure. That's what I think the average person has to ask. What's making us more secure in our continued warfare in Afghanistan?
And there is no indication from the administration that the death of bin Laden means that this open-ended warfare will come to a close anytime soon, that $13 trillion will just keep multiplying.
Well, and then we have to ask who is benefiting. And, of course, the major weapon manufacturers, so many of the people in the defense industry who are war profiteers, and certainly people in Afghanistan who profited from the war as well. There are plenty of players who don't want to see this war come to an end, and who I don't think care even vaguely about the cares and concerns of the 85% of people in Afghanistan, for instance, who are agricultural peasant laborers. Then there's also the matter of a pipeline, the Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India pipeline. And this is, maybe isn't so well known in the United States, but China has a huge need for fossil fuels and for natural gas. The United States is in great competition with China. We're indebted to China economically, but there is also certainly a competition in terms of who will emerge as the greatest superpower in the future. There is a real challenge to the United States hegemony. And so I think the United States wants that pipeline to be a means for the U.S. to control the pricing and the flow of fossil fuels like oil and also natural gas that China would want to have access to. And that may be why the United States wants so much to have bases and roadways connecting those bases. There are now 200 forward operating bases in Afghanistan along with the major bases. So is that why the United States is expected to continue the warfare in Afghanistan? And if that's the case, why doesn't the president level with the U.S. public and say, look, this is what I'm grappling with. This is why we continue this warfare. Instead, we're given many reasons to be afraid. Be afraid. If you don't bankroll this war, you're going to be at risk. But I think the U.S. public is trying to say, in public opinion polls anyway, look, we've had it. We're tired of this war. We're weary of it. But it doesn't register as a political issue, and that's our work. We have to help people translate that war weariness into a political issue. And if there was some compassion in the United States, how about the war weariness of the people who have been bearing the brunt of our bombs, our joint special operation force night raids and death squads and assassinations, our drone attacks? They're war weary. That I can tell you. I just came back from Afghanistan.
The United States, if it's not at war with Pakistan, is certainly at war in Pakistan. And yet polls show that as many as 90% of Pakistanis want to sever military connections with the United States. This sounds like a powder keg.
Well, who could blame people in Pakistan? You know, under what they call the Bush-Mush years, the reign of Pervez Musharraf in Pakistan and George Bush in the United States, the United States gave Pakistan $11 billion, $8 billion of it, which went directly to the Pakistani military and built that military up so that, well, it's the seventh largest military in the world, but also they control the pharmaceutical industry, the sugar industry, the textile industry. They own huge sections of land, and nobody can go up against the military and still have a political career. So who built up that huge military presence? And now, of course, the United States is upset because they can't entirely control what the military and what the ISI have done in Pakistan. But ordinary Pakistanis would have great reason to be offended by the way in which the United States has affected the development of their governance.
The United States is now using drones, it claims, just for surveillance in Libya. Does this indicate that drone warfare is the wave of the future for the United States, assassination from the sky?
Well, in a way, the creation of more and more drones is kind of like the Lady Gaga of the defense industry. We can count on proliferation within the United States. You know, Purdue University in Indiana has an aerospace institute, and just outside of Indianapolis. There are all kinds of startup companies, and they're manufacturing drones the size of hummingbirds. They're manufacturing the Voyeur, which is like a helicopter without the copter. It's just a rotor with the surveillance implanted. But many of these also now can carry the weapons. And, of course, the ones that are most commonly used right now can carry 4 Hellfire missiles and 1 500-pound bomb. Sure, it's used as surveillance right now in Libya, but no doubt if the NATO forces say we need United States air superiority, the United States government would be much more tempted, and this is one of the reasons why the drones are such a big problem, to go to war with unmanned aerial vehicles and to send U.S. pilots into harm's way. But see how easily countries can be tempted to go to warfare if there's not going to be any sacrifice of, you know, a hair on the head of one of their own pilots, because their own pilots and soldiers are tucked inside of U.S. bases.
And this is how the United States could maintain perpetual warfare without inflaming domestic opinion.
Well, until people start to figure out the likelihood of proliferation. I mean, there was only one atomic bomb dropped, sorry, only one country possessed the atomic bomb when Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bombed. Look at the world now. And the trillions of dollars that have been spent by countries that have made themselves part of the so-called nuclear club. There's no rationality to it, and it hasn't brought the world closer to safety.
So Americans may be looking uneasily at the skies one day.
Oh, sure. I would predict this and also say that the drone capacity can be used by domestic policing agencies. It's already being used on the borders of the United States with Mexico and with Canada. And people may find that the kind of world that we're moving into, that their children will inherit, would be one where this kind of constant surveillance would become the norm. And in terms of the weaponized drones, certainly that's something that the scientists are itching to create and make more and more available. It should be a subject for discussion. It should be a subject for intense debate. Philip Alston, the special rapporteur on extrajudicial killings for the United Nations, has tried to inject some ethical discussion into the mix. And there is one British defense minister who has said we should at least slow down and talk about this. But apart from Dennis Kucinich, I'm not aware of anyone within the United States Congress and Senate who is saying, let's talk about this.
On the same weekend that bin Laden was killed, NATO aircraft attempted to assassinate Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. We contacted former presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich on Capitol Hill. The Ohio congressman said the hit on Gaddafi was legally and morally wrong.
It's against the UN mandate to begin with. It's against the UN policy and UN charter to promote regime change by assassination. It's against moral law to assassinate another person. And so, you know, we have to ask, what is going on with NATO? They have blood on their hands. And they're trying to carry out an illegal policy of assassination, and it's a very grave matter.
NATO seems to be acting as the close air support wing of the rebels. Was that part of Resolution 1973?
It was not. As a matter of fact, the UN resolution has always been about protecting civilians. But more civilians are dying now because NATO is accelerating the war. NATO has taken the side of the rebels in what's clearly a policy of regime change that's being promoted by the White House using NATO, which, you know, I would say most American people don't understand. The U.S. pays 25% of NATO's budget. Essentially, when you say NATO, you have to say United States. But it's just said NATO to make it look like it's some anomalous, anonymous force in the world, global cop. How did it happen? This is the creation of the United States. It's U.S. policy, and it's wrong.
It seems the United States, under this administration, as with the previous administration, seems to think that if it can get a coalition together, somehow that makes illegal acts legal because there are more people doing them.
It's a novel approach to say that what you may not be able to do by yourself suddenly becomes legal because you do it with a group. Now let's apply that to conduct in civil society. If someone is using drugs on their own, heroin, cocaine, they may be subject to arrest if they get caught. But if you're involved with a group, you know, and you have a group of people involved in this or in dealing, they're not going to go free. They'll get charged with conspiracy. So it's actually a compounded crime when you're doing it with a group of people. But when you're talking about international law these days, it's really a matter of the law applies to those who have the less power. But those with the most power don't have to follow the law. They make up their own laws as they go along.
There are efforts in Congress to reword the authorization for war, the congressional authorization for war, that seem to be open-ended, that declare that the United States is at war with Al-Qaeda and with the Taliban, but also with any other groups or individuals that may be designated at any time in the future.
We've been at war for too long. We've been at war for so long that some people think that war ought to become our normal state, so that we never forget there was a time when we weren't always at war. And so, yes, you're correct that the legislation that is before the Congress right now would enable this country to stay at war permanently. I ask myself, is this what the founders had in mind when we broke from England? Or did they have in mind having a country that had the ability to defend itself, but live a life where we weren't involved with the affairs of other countries around the world and trying to dictate what other countries should do? This whole idea of war, we're destroying our democracy. There's no other way to put it. And it doesn't seem to matter if there's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. It's all the same.
Well, we see on the ground that the anti-war numbers in terms of demonstrations and other visible manifestations of opposition have decreased dramatically since the Democratic administration's been in power. To what do you attribute that?
One of the problems is that as war starts, people just get used to war, and war has a headlong momentum, and it just keeps going, and war becomes part of our everyday lives, and then war recedes into our awareness. I mean, I remember back in the Vietnam War, where after a while you read the papers every day, the stories are all there, but you stop seeing the stories that you look at every day. They're all about war. You just read something else. So Americans have moved on to something else, not really understanding that our country has moved deeper into a culture of war. And we may be focusing on sports, we may be focusing on music and movies, but guess what? Our nation is focusing more and more on war. It's becoming more and more a part of everyday life. And the American people are starting to understand that. Because why? Because our budget's militarized. Now we're cutting funds for education, for health care, for job creation, while we spend more money on war and prepare for more war, as this resolution that you cited does. So this is a very serious time in our country's history where the very democracy which we want to believe we have is in jeopardy because of militarization and because of war.
There used to be at least fairly well-defined anti-war bloc in the Congress, not a strong enough to stop any of the wars, but a bloc that could be depended upon to at least raise rhetorical opposition to the war. How fares that bloc now?
You know, there are members of Congress who are very concerned about the direction the country's going, and you'll hear from them occasionally. What we really need is a new civil rights movement in this country, which focuses on peace is at the center. And from peace, you begin to have a different international policy. America has to come home. We have to stop these wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Libya, over Yemen, over Pakistan. We have to close these bases that are around the world that are part of the World War II. Defense infrastructure. We have to begin to focus on creating jobs at home, health care for all, education for all, retirement security for all, and peace. And these are things that are possible. But we have to understand where we are right now, because where we are right now is a country that is so wrapped up in war that people don't know any other direction, and that is people in Washington. You know, sooner or later, American people are going to have to go to the streets and protest what's happening in Washington. The undermining of the hopes for the future in the name of providing national security, which is only becoming more and more threatened by the wars that we get into, by occupations that fuel insurgencies. The people are concerned about America being on a warpath, and we really have to start to see that concern reflected on Americans, just like they did during the civil rights movement. We have to go right back to the streets and let our heartfelt feelings be known.
You proposed a cabinet-level agency for peace. If that were in existence today, I guess there would be a big split in the cabinet.
It would provide a president with some options. why do we believe that war is inevitable? I mean, when you think about the belief in the inevitability of war creates war. War becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We need to believe in the possibilities of peace. I mean, this was Gandhi's teachings, Dr. King's teachings, Christ's teachings. We need to start to understand that the world that we see is the world of our own creation. And the idea of a cabinet-level Department of Peace is to begin to teach peace in our culture and to have our government start to dedicate more time and effort to the science of human relations, which carries with it the potential that we can solve our difficulties without killing each other. Now, that may seem to be a novel idea at a time when our government has stepped up policies of assassination. But we need to remember what Gandhi said, that that policies of an eye for eye soon leave everyone blind. And we have to ask ourselves whether or not we have lost our spiritual center through this increased militarization, increased use of violence in trying to solve problems, and an unwillingness to consider how we solve our difficulties without violence.
That was Congressman Dennis Kucinich speaking from Washington.
The music that young people around the world party to is actually owned by huge corporations that also dominate industries like chemicals and real estate. Black Agenda Report's Dr. Jared Ball says it's all about monopoly and money.
So the three in the Big Three, or the three largest music companies who dominate international popular culture, was just sold for $3.3 billion. Warner Music Group will now be owned by Access Industries. And just who is that? As they are happy to tell us, Access Industries is a U.S.-based industrial group with long-term holdings worldwide. Their industrial focus is in three sectors, which include natural resources and chemicals, real estate, and media and telecommunications. They are run by Russian-born Len Blavatnik, who is said to be personally worth roughly $10 billion. He is a friend and former Warner board member alongside current CEO Edgar Bronfman Jr., and even bought Bronfman's Manhattan penthouse for $50 million. The deal is being backed by banking giants UBS and Credit Suisse, and each side is assured massive $50 to $60 million paydays should either back out of the deal before November. Word is also that Blavatnik plans to go after the four in the Big Four, which is EMI, and which is currently owned by another major banking institution, Citi. This is no small matter. All the heavy hitters are in this mix, and all protections for all involved are in place. I have to say it again, from the perspective of those who own it, the music industry is fine, and what's to come is going to be even better. For them, the future is so bright, I won't even bother to finish that line. Those who suffered the industry's abuse in the 1980s know it well and can finish it for me. Which is also the point. The music industry is another that is apparently considered by the international business and banking community to be too big to fail. This is why, despite those persistent claims that the music business is dying, major money steps in to preserve maintenance over the world's popular culture. Yes, Blavatnik and Bronfman are reportedly friends, but that's not why the former is buying the company and assuming the $2 billion debt belonging to his friend, the latter. No, as the head of media for Access Industries has said, the music industry is at an inflection point where digital adoption is rapidly gaining momentum. Warner Music, as one of the most progressive forces in the music business, is well positioned to capture this opportunity for music creation and distribution. On sports radio this week, the one called the sports industry's super agent, David Falk, discussed the now legendary deal he struck on behalf of Michael Jordan and Nike that resulted in the Air Jordan franchise, which he said is still roughly 94% of the athletic shoe market. He talked about the role of advertising and why it was necessary for Nike's ad budget to be roughly $500 to $600 million. Because, as Falk said, it's this initial investment that yields Nike $20 billion in sales. In other words, Blavatnik's investment in music is expected to bring cultural returns in the way his investment in Oxford University's Blavatnik School of Business is meant to bring returns in the world of business. Each serve as advertisements, and ads serve, of course, as promotion, but also as assurances of control over content. And what is that content? Judging by this week's list of top 10 songs aired on radio across the country, of which Blavatnik's new property owns four, he is getting plenty to assure that no one raises a fuss about a world that makes him and his colleagues awfully powerful. Even with the Warner-owned Lupe fiasco, who is proof that progressive ideas can be as hot as their opposite,
The presence of artists like Pitbull, Wiz Khalifa, and the New Boys do more than erase his potential impact. And besides, as dope as he is, Lupe is only progressive in the musical vacuum created by the forced omission of Dead Prez, Godzilla, or Kelly Love Jones. It is no different than Obama being seen as a progressive in the political vacuum left after the forced omission of Malcolm X, Dr. King, or Cynthia McKinney. Ownership of music and this kind of influence over popular culture is never about money. It is an investment in the advertising that protects against vital questions being raised about how our world is being governed and for whom it is so ordered. If we wiggle to or are distracted by his music, we are less likely to raise questions about Blavatnik's massive holdings in oil or in the world's third largest independent chemical company or in the world's largest vertically integrated aluminum company. More importantly, it is so we are less likely to raise questions about a world order that allows for these industries to exist at all, or the profit they create to go only to a global handful.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Kyle Pollard.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.